Welcome to Switchblade Sisters. We have a very special episode this week because we are in the middle of our Max Fun Drive, which ends Friday, March 29th. So, in addition to our conversation with the Soska sisters, we'll also have a conversation with Michelle Meek, author of Independent Female Filmmakers, a chronicle through interviews, profiles, and manifestos. There will also be two pledge breaks to discuss the Max Fun Drive that will explain how and why you should support our show. Max Fun Drive, as I should remind you guys, is the best time of the year. It's like our Christmas here. This is when we get to see all of the people who listen to us, supporting us online, and we get to say thank you. And now let's get to the show. Today, I'm real excited to have writers-directors Jen and Sylvia Soska calling in from Canada.
Thank you so much for having us. We're so excited to be here.
Oh, thank you, April. This is so cool to be here.
For those of you guys who aren't familiar with the Soska work, please let me give you an introduction. The Soska sisters, and actually, I usually write the bios for people, but the one that you provided was so perfect that it, and it had so much energy that I'm just going to read straight through their bio that
they gave.
The Soska sisters are Canadian twin badasses who didn't like what they saw in the entertainment industry and took it upon themselves to fix it. After initially setting out to be actresses and finding themselves auditioning for too many stereotypical roles, they decided to create their own film with empowered female characters, a film that would change indie scene forever called Dead Hooker in a Trunk. I love that name. Content with being outsiders, they followed up their grindhouse hit with the stylized body modification tale American Mary, which cemented their place as a pair to be watched. Always wants to break new ground and keep audiences guessing, they went on to become the first female directors hired by the WWE and resurrected the See No Evil 2 franchise with WWE superstar Kane, and followed it up with Vendetta, which turned Dean Kane into a vengeful cop turned convict, hell-bent on bringing down WWE's The Big Show. Huge personalities on and off screen, this dynamic duo captured the attention of Blumhouse and followed in the hostessing footsteps of their heroine, Elvira, to host Blumhouse's survival horror game show, Hellevator. And while the two seek to create better and more diversified roles for women in entertainment, their strong and vocal support for causes of gender equality, blood donation, and LGBTQ2 rights is just one facet of their filmmaking careers. Catch them recently, fresh off the remaking of David Cronenberg's Rabid, and as the current writers for Marvel's Black Widow, which is like, okay, Rabid, when are we going to be able to see Rabid?
Oh my God, well, I've seen it, so no, I'm it's going to be this year. And actually, we're waiting to see which film festivals it's going to be premiering at. There's a chance it might be Fantasia, it might be Tribeca, it might be TIFF, or it might be Fright Fest. And I know when the theatrical is happening, but you know, I think it's an appropriate time for a horror movie, and I think I've probably already said too much.
Well, it'll be later than summer and earlier than Christmas. There's a perfect time. Hey, I didn't say anything. I just heavily implied.
Well, Jen, Sylvia, going into a movie that we will be discussing today, I would love for you to tell me why you guys chose David Cronenberg's Dead Ringers.
Well, Jennifer and I love David Cronenberg. As a matter of fact, the first time I saw a David Cronenberg film, I didn't even know what it was because, you know, you'd have to sneak them when you're a child. And it was Shivers, and I had never seen anything like that before. And then later, I missed the beginning of another movie, and it turned out to be Crash. And both movies left me with this same kind of strange feeling. So then eventually when we did see Dead Ringers, it just, I mean, being identical twins, there's so many stereotypical depictions about what that relationship is like. And that relationship really showed the weirdness and the eccentricities and almost the symbiotic kind of relationship, especially identical twins have. I mean, Jennifer and I are mirror identical twins. For the first few weeks, we were Siamese. I mean, that's as connected as you can get.
Yeah, yes.
David Cronenberg's work has had such a huge inspiration on us. I remember The Fly. I'm sure I watched Shivers with you, but The Fly, I still can't even watch it without being so disgusted. I tried to eat lunch once, just once, while watching it. And I think Dead Ringers was actually one of his last films that we watched because I was so adverse to the idea of watching, okay, here's one actor playing twins. This is going to be awful. And it was the exact opposite. Mm. It was so breathtaking that I thought, okay, so David either desperately loves twins and has such a
amazing understanding on them, or he's just accidentally a genius. But I couldn't.
Both.
He's both.
He's otherworldly.
He's not accidentally in anything. He is absolutely
a
genius.
He's very purposeful about what he does, that's for sure.
And that film, I mean, it's also how I love to see a film that defies genre. I mean, people call it a horror film or a thriller, but for me, it's a drama. I mean, for an identical twin, it's the scariest thing that you could possibly go through.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. As soon as you get into the third act, Jennifer and I are just like completely glassy-eyed, crying like Jen's nickname is Ellie and I'm Bev. And I'm like, oh no, poor Ellie.
Poor Bev.
Oh, no. I mean, how do you... Okay, I'll get into this. I want to ask you how you choose which one of you is Ellie and which one of you is Bev. But for those of you... For those who haven't seen Dead Ringers, today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. My motto is that always is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you want to pause and watch Dead Ringers first, this is your chance. And now that you're back, let me introduce Dead Ringers. Written by Norman Snyder and David Cronenberg and directed by Cronenberg for release in 1988, Dead Ringers stars Jeremy Irons as identical twin brothers Elliot and Beverly Mantle. Elliot and Beverly accept awards and applauds for their gynecological work, reversing infertility.
The Mantle retractor, which is now the standard of the industry. Here's to a brilliant future.
Elliot is the more aggressive of the two, seducing women and then pawning them off on Beverly when he's tired of them.
Actually, I was the one who fucked you first, but I gave you to my baby brother because you weren't very good.
But when an actress named Claire Neveu comes in and gets diagnosed with a cervix that has three openings, she upends their lives after Elliot seduces her and gives her to Beverly, who then falls in love with Claire. Beverly starts doing drugs with Claire, too. Elliot impersonates Beverly to try to get closer with Claire again, and then Claire eventually confronts both twins at a bar.
Let's be frank, okay, Elliot? Let's ease up on the bullshit for one moment. You can be honest with me. After all, I am laying both of you, aren't I?
Before informing them that she would like an exclusive relationship with Beverly only. Claire takes off to film a movie, which sends Beverly spiraling into drug use and depression to the point where he commissions some seriously fucked up gynecological tools that haunt me to this day.
Well, I need three-dimensional prototypes in surgical steel, cast, hand-finished, functioning. And I thought maybe...
Aren't there large companies in this town that could help you out with that?
No, I can't go to them. It's too radical for them. We've always been too radical.
And then assaults a patient during surgery. The twins are suspended from practicing their medicine. Elliot locks Beverly in a clinic and sinks up their blood by taking drugs himself so they can both come down together. Beverly gets sober and goes back to Claire, but gets worried about Elliot and returns to the clinic.
I'll come back.
Your brother won't let you come back.
How could he stop me?
Only to find him totally fucked up and essentially volunteering to die. Beverly uses his fucked up gynecology tools to disembowel Elliot. Beverly calls Claire but hangs up on the phone when she asks, "Who is this?" and returns to his brother to wrap himself in Elliot's limp arms. Okay.
Wow, right? Right? And that happens on their birthday, the last scene, which is the most depressing thing.
Happy birthday, guys.
Would you like a piece of cake? Separation can be terrifying. It can be painful. It's true. It's true. I mean, we've been from the womb to the tomb. We've always been roommates. We've always worked together. I mean, I can relate to those two characters so much, but also,
not every twin is that close. But when I saw that relationship, because, you know, there you always see the, and I know that there's the male audience that loves the female twins fighting.
Yeah.
But the reality is the twins, like real ones, are just like one unified unit. There isn't a secret between the two of us.
Well, that's true. That's why I love that line. You haven't experienced something until I have. And it's absolutely true. In school, they tried to separate Jennifer and me because they said we'd become codependent. Like one would get stronger in other ways and the other one would get stronger in different ways. But I guess they never thought we would run a company together where that is actually an awesome strength where I'm like, okay, well, this is obviously a Jen problem now. I will see you guys later.
Oh, yeah. It's so rare to see that relationship so realistically portrayed, and by our hero, David Cronenberg. I mean, that was unbelievable when I first saw Dead Ringers. It just, like, floored me.
Yeah, and we've
as fellow Canadians, I'm sure it's just a separate kind of jubilation.
Absolutely. He should be on the money. He should be on the money.
Yeah, we should have a David Cronenberg holiday. I think it's just such a disservice that Canada doesn't have, like, about 10 to 20, maybe $40 million aside every year just for a Cronenberg movie. Just like, here we go. We're
whatever
just going to treat the world.
Yeah, go for it, David. Whatever you want. Go for it. Call up Viggo Mortensen. Let's do it.
Yeah, I remember when we were doing our Rabbit, actually, we had one of the stars from Dead Ringers do a cameo, Heidi von Palisk. And of course, we waited for 2 seconds before being like, I need to hear every single story you have about making that movie. I mean,
oh my God.
The dancing scene alone. And I remember she was saying, you guys should recreate that. I was like, that would be so sexy to do one day.
She guessed which one was Ellie and which one was Bev. When she guessed, I was like, oh, wow, of course you would know.
Well, yeah, what she was talking about the film, it was so interesting because Jeremy also wanted to have like two different trailers so he would feel like two different identities when he was creating those characters. I remember he even had like a rock in one of the shoes. So.
In both shoes. Mm-hmm. And as one, he had it at the balls of his feet and one in the heels of his feet.
And it's so ridiculous to me that David Cronenberg wasn't nominated for an Oscar and Jeremy Irons wasn't nominated for an Oscar because you have two characters completely different, played by the same guy, and both of them become drug addicts that are totally different and indistinguishable from each other. While they blend their personalities.
1988 was a magical year for that.
It was, and I have to say, I wanted to, you know, give a quote from Cronenberg when it talks about, you know, kind of the history of twins, because you guys were hitting on something where you're like, most twins are terrible representations. It's usually women. There's like the bad and there's a good.
Yes.
He said, these twins are real people. There's no shtick for them to hide behind. One of them doesn't wear an eye patch or something. One of them isn't flamboyantly evil while the other is the embodiment of innocence. It's two real people. Both very complex, very subtle, and the actor is right out there having to make these twins similar but different. So that kind of feeds into everything that you guys are saying.
Oh, he's so genius. We were actually, after we finished shooting Rabid, gifted with getting to finally meet him, and I can't tell you what an amazing experience it is to sit across from David Cronenberg and talk about Dead Ringers. I remember the first thing he said when we had to gush about everything, and then he was quiet for a moment, and then he said, yeah, I had to go through about 40 actors before I could find someone because nobody wanted to play a gynecologist. And the first European actor said yes. So I was like, wow.
He was so funny. He said how all the North American actors, all the men were afraid of women's bodies. They wouldn't play a gynecologist.
Yeah, there's the interviews around this time when he was kind of getting down on the American male actor
and
the way that they felt so emasculated by having this kind of profession. He was feeling like they all wanted to play cops.
Yeah.
They always wanted to play criminals. But the idea that they would play kind of like a sensitive sibling who was affected by, you know, their brother's pain and then was also deep in someone's vagina, like out of a job, was just too much. They just wouldn't latch onto it. No one would sign on.
No, and he was so ahead of his time. Even if today we went to any kind of studio and said, we're going to do a movie about these twin gynecologists and this woman with three openings to her vagina, they're going to say, what? No. And then he makes these monstrous gynecological tools. And there's actually an operation scene with it. Wait, what? No. Who would play those? It would never happen.
But hilariously, the aftermath is Jeremy Irons is such a sex symbol. I mean, as those two characters. Mm-hmm. Oh, I love watching it because the first thing we do, because even though we've watched it so many times, we're like, which one's Bev? Which one's Ellie? Okay, is that Ellie playing Bev right now? Or is that Bev for real right now?
Well, I love that opening scene where you kind of get everything about the relationship, where they're talking about fish having sex and they're in water so they don't have to touch each other to procreate, and Bev says, I'd love that, that'd be better. And then you understand, like, he has a problem with intimacy. His brother doesn't, but his brother's trying to help, like, fix that relationship for him.
Elliot does have a problem with intimacy.
Oh, in a totally different way. But that's the thing, because they're always, everybody's so obsessed with this good twin, bad twin aspect. But the thing is, twins are so complicated. And I mean, I know with my relationship with Jen, we built our social construct from a relationship with the two of us. So when we went into elementary school and other kids would tease us or lie, we didn't understand that because we didn't
do that because we were like a unit. It was just such a weird thing for us.
Yeah, growing up in a weird twin social structure, it's basically like having someone to think out loud with. And there's no reason to lie to your twin because what gain could you have? But then when we went out into the world, it was a little bit like the invention of lying where we had to be like, oh, wait. People are less sincere because when you're a twin, you're either 100% open with your twin and you kind of bring that into your other relationships, mm-hmm. or you're not at all.
And I think that's why what happened with Bev at towards the end of Dead Ringers happens, because he cuts off that relationship he has with Elliot because this woman says, oh, I want to have just share this with you. And he's never had that kind of intimate connection with another person. And then he loses the person that he can discuss these ideas with outside of his head. And he does have mental illness. He never really discusses it, but his therapist is almost his brother. They discuss these ideas and they keep each other in check. And when that's gone, it's funny how David is so well versed in science and medicine that when that separation happens, it almost feels medical. It almost feels clinical. It almost feels like a virus pulling them apart.
Well, they have sexual deviation from childhood. I mean, it's very impressive that a couple of smart little nerdy boys learn how to master a woman's body so well and position themselves in a career where, I'll get chicks eventually. I mean, some of them are going to sleep with their doctor.
That's all people, isn't it? I'm like, this will get me chicks. This will get me dudes.
That's something that I think, you know, one of the reasons why Cronenberg really wanted them to be gynecologists, though, was because, I don't know if he calls himself a feminist, but dude was very, very adamant about him being a gynecologist because of how male-dominated that profession is and how it puts women at an immediate weakness.
Yes.
You know, like he was in interviews kind of describing it's like an easy way to make a character feel intimidating because you've got a woman who's in stirrups and she's never met this guy and he's going to come and be so immediately intimate with her. And so the power structure and the power dynamic was something that he was really, really interested in exploring. And I find that, you know, it's a fascinating thing to see a man who's well aware of that stuff. I know as women, I mean, when you two are making movies, you're aware of that because it's part of your life, you know?
Well, yeah. Also being identical twins, Penthouse has always been nice to us when they've interviewed us, but I'm like, you did no favors for us growing up and all that, like, countdown for the Olsen twins. Like, I mean, I love the sexuality in Cronenberg's films because it's almost like a controlled, it's an artistic look at it. But being identical twins in the world, you almost have it, like, thrust upon you constantly with context and questions and things like that, that it's so nice to see sexuality explored in a real human way in this movie, even though it does get towards a more of a kinky kind of a medical way. At least it's more respectful than the kind of incest kind of tagline that people always try to see. Or, do you fight with your sister? I get that so many times when they ask me about movies. They're like, do you fight with your sister? It's like, why would they trust me with millions of dollars then? That would be insane, don't you think?
We usually have the tickle fight before the bubble bath, though, to be fair.
That's fair.
I love how self-aware Cronenberg is of the real-life horror of being a woman well before it was cool to be acknowledging it back in, like, 1988. And there's that horrible scene where Beverly is using the wrong part of the mantle retractor in that woman. Yeah. And he just has her with her legs up.
When did you last have a period?
I haven't had one in 4 or 5 months.
And does it hurt when you have intercourse?
Yes, it does.
He's so cold and he's so rude to her that I'm like, is this Elliot now? And I'm like, oh no, it's Bev and he's sick right now. And because it's so terrible. And then Elliot is very gently saying, you used the wrong part. I mean, that's supposed to be for internal surgery, not for examining a woman.
But think of that with medical horror and, like, just the trust you give a doctor.
Oh, of course.
You just assume they're doing what they're supposed to. You assume they have your better interest. They assume this. And, I mean, you have to go a little nutty when you're just looking at human anatomy or you're in a job where you cut open a person. Like, every time I meet a doctor and I make sure that they're prepared, there's going to be a weird question coming. I'm like, so what is it like actually cutting into a person? Because doesn't that go against every sign of what you are as a human? They're like, oh, we usually start on cadavers. And it's a bit weird the first few times.
It has to be an emotional disassociation.
Well, and that's why you get this weird vacuum of people of how they act. I mean, you can't be present all the time when you're doing that kind of stuff.
I want to go back real quick to the thing that you guys were saying about the, you know, kind of who goes into this profession, the kind of like the intensity of the actual kind of surgery that's happening and how he's setting up those scenes, because I really love to visit that one scene where he's getting dressed and he's wearing red scrubs.
Oh, that iconic scene, the one where he's operating basically on heroin and he grabs the gas mask off of the patient and he's
you know, it's such a great tension moment because you do get to see the surgery scenes when they know what they're doing. Where outside, Elliot's explaining and Beverly's doing the surgery perfect, and you see as Beverly is getting more into his addiction, the middle surgery scene is his hands shaking and while he's trying to move a rod inside someone, and you're already like, oh my God, please don't be doing this. And again, it's kind of that high wire tension act where you know he has a drug problem. Elliot knows he has a drug problem, but he's still operating on women. And at the very last part where he has that iconic, his hands are out, the red vestments are being put on, it's almost like you already saw that there's a bomb underneath the table and it's got like 30 seconds to go. And you're like, oh, no. What's he going to do? And imagine that vulnerability. That woman is there and he doesn't even tell anybody that he's had these tools made for operating on mutant women. And he just puts it down. He's like, this is the one we'll be using today.
Yeah, just number them 1 to 10. And that's also the kind of real life social horror that made Funny Games just such a disturbing film, because the surgeons, the assisting surgeons, obviously know this is insane. But of course, the Mantle brothers created the Mantle retractor, which was thought insane originally. Yeah. So who can you even like dare a question? But then the woman's bleeding, he jumps over. My God, it's just even at the point where when this secretary comes in and he has the effing needle in his arm and she's like, I can't work under these conditions, I'm giving my notice. I'm like, bitch, just say you're leaving. Just say I quit. You're on drugs. Don't say I'm going to give you 2 weeks, Dr. Mantle.
But you
out of respect.
Out of how graphic it is, it's amazing, because to me, one of the most horrible parts of that is when he's out of the office and they keep grabbing gauze with clamps and putting it between her legs, and your brain is just like, oh my God, what did he do with that claw? What did he do?
You don't even hear. You just hear she's bleeding, and that's the claw, the same thing that he eventually uses to separate himself and Elliot. And I love that it's insect-shaped, since David has that fascination with insects.
Yeah, there's always some kind of organic thing that's coming into the inorganic that he has. But when it comes to that scene, you know, he was really feeling that it was kind of a religious ceremony in a sense,
you know,
the red vestments, even though that's not realistic, it was supposed to be representative of a cardinal being kind of put in. You said vestments correctly, obviously, because that's, you know, how he would be dressed. And so as a fairly anti-religious person, you know, he didn't want to get militant about it, you know, when he was kind of relating religion and work together. But he felt that, like, with the absence of religion, that work steps in and can become all-consuming and kind of warp your brain in that manner. And you know, this is a guy who, like, he is kind of like the high priest of gynecology. And so, yeah, people are like, oh, yeah, we love you. But, you know, he's also like the Pope, and he's going to make some really terrible mistakes, most likely.
And it's such a cool illusion between those two things, because science and religion, they're absolute. You don't question God. You don't question science. This must be somebody much smarter than you already decided these things, and these are the rules that we exist in.
In a way, they're absolutely interchangeable, because there are a lot of people who classify themselves as atheists or agnostic. They've put science in the place of their religion. And sometimes when people don't have any kind of spirituality or any kind of, let's say, moral belief system, it's so easy for themselves to put themselves in this God complex area. I mean, obviously, he's a drug addict having a mental breakdown, and his twin brother should not be letting him do surgery. I mean, my God, Elliot, I know you don't like talking to people, but for the love of God, just like suffer through one of your days.
But think about it. They only do fertility. So they are playing God. They're making life. They're making women fertile. Like that funny scene where he's like, we don't do husbands. I'm like,
even that is so sexual. fertility. It's like it is literally like the little boy who didn't get laid and who that the girls were mean to them. I know as a fact you don't know what fuck is. Like all that stuff. You know, you can see the mental illness when they're having sex. You know, you can see how powerless they feel by how powerful they need to be.
You can see the mental illness in every character except Heidi. Heidi's got her shit so together. She could talk. She could be their therapist.
She's like an ethereal being. Yeah. I mean, the way she looks, the way she speaks, the way that she has her shit so much more together than these guys.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break. We'll also be talking a little bit more about Heidi, but we'll be talking about how to work with actors and how David Cronenberg has worked with his actors. So one quick break. Hey, it's your host, April Wolf, and I'm joined by Drea. Hi, Drea Clark.
Hi,
how are
April
you?
Wolf. I'm so good. I'm excited because I saw you wanted to give me the 50 Cent song lead up again.
And I couldn't do it.
It's so good. I know, sometimes you don't stick the landing. It's what, and then you keep rolling. It's what happens.
I don't, like, the thing is that I couldn't even remember the words. And I was like, what? So, Drea, we're here today talking about, gratitude first.
Namaste.
I mean, I feel so thankful. Why am I thankful?
You're thankful because it's the Max Fun Drive and it's been going well. And I will say there is something about it's hard to say when you need support for things.
Yes.
And just being online during the Fun Drive has been kind of this unexpectedly nice reaction because so many people have been tweeting about it or commenting on tweets.
Oh, my God.
In the nicest,
so sweet.
Like, high five, virtual hug kind of way. So I think that the Max Fun Drive has been a really cool endeavor, if not just because it's leading towards keeping the doors open and keeping our shows going, but because the community that's come out and how we're seeing it is legit authentically cool.
It is. And it's so nice specifically for our show, Switchblade Sisters, for people to see, you know, that women in film matter. I mean, I hate having to say it, but, you know, the things that we're doing on the show, the reasons that we're doing the show, which is to get women talking about craft and process and to get people really excited about genre and to just show what women can do, like all of those things. It's just so nice that people are responding so well to that and that they are throwing their dollars behind that, and we appreciate it.
Well, it is such an unusual thing to see. Like, I love, because I listen to the show, and I love that when you talk to filmmakers, you're just talking to filmmakers. They happen to be women or identify as women. Mm-hmm. It's not how you're announcing them, and you don't start it with that, like, horrible, what's it like to be a female in the industry? Because there's a whole approach to that, that they're kind of tired. What you're actually asking them is, let's talk about this righteous film that gets you excited, and how does it influence your own stuff? And I know that, this was one that I listened to recently, is you talked to Sandy Tan. She made this dope documentary called Shirkers, which I highly recommend. And you talked to her about freaking David Lynch's Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that the woman who made a film like Shirkers, just seeing the film she picked is already insight, but then hearing her process of it, I don't know, I love that. I love it. It's such a unique way into how filmmakers and artists think about their medium.
Absolutely. And we've got another one of my favorites, Issa Mistey, who did the movie Cam, that people can see on Netflix, that people just fucking love. It is such a great, great horror film about doppelgangers in the sex worker industry, and she chose to talk about Jennifer's Body, a Karin Kusama film, and we already had Karin Kusama on the show earlier, you know, last year. And
so full circle.
It's a full circle thing, and I love being able to get into these, like, the nitty gritty of certain aspects of a film that you just wouldn't normally get to.
And Switchblade Sisters is truly the only podcast of its kind. Like, it's why supporting it at the Max Fun Drive is so important, because what you're doing and the outlet that you give to the artists you do is really unique. It's a very cool thing for people to be able to experience. So supporting that makes all the sense in the world.
Okay, so what's the ask? How are we asking them to support us?
We are asking them to, it's first off, it's an easy website. They go to Al Gore's internet, maximumfun.org/donate. And then they can be a monthly member, or they can increase their monthly membership. We're aiming for 25,000 new or increased memberships during this Max Fund drive.
Yeah, it's so exciting. And I think that we can get to 25,000.
Right?
Yes.
25,000 people have to like us.
Yes. And it's one of those things where when you go to that website, MaximumFund.org/donate, make sure that you check off Switchblade Sisters.
Yes. Well, then it goes directly to this one.
Yeah, we've got, you know, Casey works so hard putting this show together. We got to give an applause
producer,
to Casey.
Come on, clap,
producer,
clap, clap.
Is, you know, and as a producer yourself, Drea, you understand the work that goes into making
it
something
is legitimately
good.
Thankless, but also kind of a dream. Yeah, you guys bring in great people. It's such a good show.
And I think the best time to do this, to support, is now. It's during the Maximum Fun drive, MaximumFun.org/donate. Now. Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by the Soska Sisters in Canada. And we are talking about Dead Ringers. Okay, so I want to talk about working with actors. You know, we've talked a little bit about Jeremy Irons and some of the things that he was doing, how it was kind of hard for David Cronenberg to find an American actor who might be interested in doing something like this. But I would love to talk about just the general ins and outs of working with your actors, you know, like how you make them feel comfortable, for instance. Because one of the things that David Cronenberg said was he showed the script to everyone. Right. And even to, you know, the female actors, to Jeremy Irons. And he was saying that it was really hard for them, even if after they had kind of signed on, because they weren't exactly sure how the gynecology scenes would be shot. And everyone was so freaked out about that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he said he felt that they were tastefully done, most of them, you know. And of course, we don't really see much. He said, when I was sending the script around, I was describing the doctor who examines the woman, and I didn't say the camera sees this, the camera doesn't see that. And that was something I had to discuss with my actors before they would agree to even do the movie. And that's why, how I was intended to shoot these scenes. So I was curious, you know, if you guys are directing some blood, some gore, a lot of stuff, is that the kind of way that you have to walk your actors through and just like let them know, like, this is exactly what it's going to look like? Or are people just kind of game for it?
You know, I think it's mostly people's agents and managers that tell them not to work with us, because we are known for pushing boundaries, definitely, in the things that we do. I would say we had the same struggles that David had with the gynecology scenes with body modification, because when we made American Mary, everyone said, "Ew, that's disgusting. Oh, that's freakish." And I said, no. It's just a different ideal of what is beautiful. I actually prefer body modification to most cosmetic surgery, because body modification is, by and large, someone pursuing their own ideal of what they think is beautiful. Cosmetic surgery, more often than not, is, you know, kind of pursuing somebody else's ideal of beauty. And, you know, a lot of work can be done with self-esteem. Someone with cat ears or a forked tongue is not doing it to impress someone. They're just trying to do it for themselves. Mm-hmm. So when we were pitching American Mary and we said, you know, voluntary amputations, tongue splitting, 3D subdermal implants, people said, "Oh, ew, that's going to be terrifying." We said, no. It's going to be the most beautiful stuff you've ever seen.
There's a clitorectomy, and I'm like, it's going to be so tastefully shot. How could I even put that in there without it being tastefully shot?
It is the most beautiful clitorectomy that's ever done. I mean, there's a character, spoiler alert, named Ruby Real Girl, who has a very Barbie doll figure, but unlike what she appears to be maybe by the male gaze, she doesn't want to be sexualized. She just wants to be this beautiful, non-sexual, super feminine creation. So she has her nipples taken off and she has her lady bits sealed up as much as possible.
Yeah, and we actually shot a faux trailer for that at first, because we had just made Dead Hooker in a Trunk, which was like a total grindhouse crazy movie. And so people read the script and they're like, "Oh no, it's going to be graphic, it's going to be crazy. Nobody can handle this. Why would you ever make it?" And then, thank God, Jen is such a great person for talking to people. It came on pretty well, and we had met Catherine Isabel on the set of Josie and the Pussycats, and we always loved her from Ginger Snaps. And every time I watched her in a movie, and I was like, "Oh, I wish she did this," or "I wish she did that." And I'm like, "Oh, she's so talented. One of these days." And then when we got to writing the script, I was like, "I'm going to write it for Catherine Isabel. Who knows? Maybe she'll do it." And she did.
I want to get into where Cronenberg had actually decided that Jeremy Irons could do this. He said, I think it was seeing the movie Moonlighting that suggested that he could do this. There's no direct connection, but he was so quietly humorous and sweet, and it's almost a silent movie, which meant that body language was important, and he did that so well. Certainly, he does often seem very arrogant and distant on film, but he's also very charismatic. And then when we met him, I found him very funny and very playful, and all those things together convinced me that he could do it, that it would just be a question of normal directing. And I like that, that he was just was looking for physicality and kind of like quiet, subtle mannerisms.
It shows you how next level David is when he's already analyzing how he's going to do something, because they had to do such interesting camera movement and work with doubles just to replicate that the same actor was playing identical twins. And just that movement, knowing he had the ability to move as two different people, then two different people going through different psychological journeys. It's
and two mm-hmm. different people impersonating each other. Mm-hmm. And the work where it was with doubles, I mean, it was so seamless. So I was watching it again just last night to freshen up, and I was like, my God, you don't spend one moment being like, oh, that's the body double, or oh, that's what's the stand-in.
You think, no,
yeah, never.
Yeah, what I have found most amazing was the last scene when they're both complete drug addicts, and I could tell which one was Ellie and I could tell which one was Bev exactly, and their hair was both messed up, and they're dressed like twins. Like, that's just so amazing. And it's interesting because I think it was because of the content that they weren't acknowledged by the Academy, because the next year Jeremy Irons of course won, and then he thanked David Cronenberg and everybody. I mean, it's just interesting that he always felt like a bit of an outsider with his work, and it's surprising because his work is such a big part of the world, a big part of how actors get known for things, but nobody mm-hmm. wants to say that's how I know them. I'd never watched a movie like that, but of course everyone is.
You know, and Jeremy Irons too, people were like, oh, why are you doing a horror movie? You know, because everyone was still thinking about Cronenberg as The Fly. And, you know, yeah. especially in Hollywood, they're like, The Fly, The Fly, The Fly. But Irons said, I'm very pleased to do horror. That's a plus for me as an actor. I want to play to different segments of the audience. You're always asked to do what you just done. Movies are a high risk business, and they tend to, if they have a mauve colored character, they think, oh, let's get him for this mauve character. I try constantly to sidestep that. I shall never be things I like this close. I shall never be asked to play a 5-foot Appalachian coal miner, but there are other things for a 6-foot Irishman.
Oh, he's so charming.
Oh, he is so charming. And he was, even the way he moved, like, remember when he had that nice suit at the very end, and he was seeing Bev in his room, and then he was coming out and he was trying to maintain his life, but you can see him popping pills. I thought he looked like he was in American Psycho. It's like, he's so well dressed, he's so put together, and like, how could people not be fighting each other for that role? I was like, people would kill for that kind of opportunity if they're brave enough, though.
Yeah, it's a scary thing, because you could look silly if you're not as talented as Jeremy Irons.
Can you imagine if you're not good and you're trying to do it, then you're just going to do what, you know, David Cronenberg was trying not to do, which is like the evil and the good. And, you know, Cronenberg says this a bunch when he ever talks about Dead Ringers, is that you would ask anyone on the street, oh, would an actor like to challenge themselves playing a twin? And be like, yes. But then the reality of that is that most actors actually balk at it, because it does take a certain kind of experience level to craft it off without actually being a trope, you know, and these characters aren't tropes. And I really love that the way that, you know, aside from just like the small things of like separate trailers and like rocks in the shoes, he was essentially saying, you know, Jeremy Irons, that he is trying to make a difference in their energy levels, he said. The difference between them is their energy levels, and if you play that, it actually makes you different. Your face changes, your body changes, you speak in a different way and stand in a different way. So he was just thinking about energy. How much energy does this character have, and how much energy does that character have?
Wow. And
oh, that's fascinating.
So well.
You can see that. You can definitely see that.
And you can see that energy thing, especially when Elliot goes on the date with the actress at first, and Bev has to go to get the grant, and he's like, how did we do? And then he starts, just drops into an Elliot impersonation, and it's not Elliot, but it's Bev doing Elliot. And it's from Bev being just like so melancholy to just being this like suave, kind of almost Jeff Goldblum kind of tomcat.
Due cappuccini per favore, and quickly. The Countess is a tigress until she's got her caffeine in the morning.
Hey, come on. I'm not that bad.
Seeing them split screen, like, that was unbelievable, because you're acting to your performance at another time. And there isn't, it's like 1988 was Who Framed Roger Rabbit,
yes,
as well.
The other film, mm-hmm, that was like, wow, a master of it wasn't there, but it looks like it was there.
It was just so fantastic when Beverly comes up and gives his drunken speech about how he does everything for those women except sticking it in them.
Yeah, that's classy.
And then you just have Elliot just so gracefully trying to save face, and even in the same frame, like, obviously they're not acting opposite each other, but they are. It's fantastic. You can't tell me Eddie Valiant doesn't see Roger Rabbit.
Yeah, and the motions too, like at the very end where Bev is like so high and Elliot says the story, it first brings up the story about Chang and Aang, which is the whole beautiful end where as soon as you hear it, you're like, oh no, you guys are doomed. But he's bawling and the other one's just totally out of it. To have those emotional beats and be acting to yourself and not even be acting to yourself, it's just a soliloquy after soliloquy. It's amazing.
I mean, I think that we should say something about this dialogue and the things that the twins get away with saying to one another, this kind of heightened dialogue that they have. It's almost philosophical in a sense. I think it's really lovely, and it's a credit to David Cronenberg that he was able to kind of build up this world where lines like what in the end where he's like,
I've often thought there should be beauty contests for the insides of bodies. You know, best spleen, most perfectly developed kidneys. Why don't we have standards of beauty for the entire human body?
That's a line that could come off as maybe too melodramatic or somewhere else in a different kind of movie. But, you know, this is a film that earns those kinds of close thought sharing between these twins.
Yeah, and you have to wonder how much experience David Cronenberg had with twins, because he has that medical experience. So when he talks about like a perfect spleen, you're like, well, that makes sense, because we're all looking at our skin suits of what's the most attractive. And, you know, I can almost picture an American accent reading that actor reading that line and being like, yeah, no, I don't know how the hell I'm going to say that to any woman after I've had a sex scene. That's weird.
But it is so intimate. And I bet David Cronenberg, like most of us, pick through produce at the grocery store. He could tell you what a perfect heart should look like.
A perfect spleen.
All right, it's a good time to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking a little bit more about some of the invisible effects that we were kind of touching on, and also the idea of intensity and obsession driving your filmmaking. We'll be right back. Hey, it's your host, April Wolf, again. You thought you got rid of me. You didn't. I'm back, and guess who else is back?
Drea Clark, you didn't get rid of me neither.
Oh, we're here to talk about the Maximum Fun Drive again, because I'm sure that all you Max Fun listeners are just having such a good time listening to all of your hosts be like, hey, come to Jesus here. Hey.
We put on our most serious voices.
I'm going to lower my voice an octave because...
You're going to go full Elizabeth Holmes.
I've got something to talk about.
You also went slightly British.
I don't know. Okay. Well, we're talking about the Max Fun Drive.
Yes. In addition to the gifts, audio gifts, like April doing a deeper British accent,
definitely,
there are physical gifts you can get for helping us out, which I love, because the monthly membership is a nice thing. It's spread out so it doesn't seem as, oh, this is a big investment. No, it's a small. It's a little thank you in the tip jar of your month.
It's $5 a month, $10 a month, you know.
And so on.
$20 a month, $35 a month. It goes on.
It goes on. And for each of those, there's a really great... things that you can get in addition to the glow of being a Max Fun supporter.
Hey, yo, that $5 monthly membership gets...
This is your favorite one, even though it's the most, like, low level, like, come on in and be an easy member.
Yeah.
Because it's the bonus content level.
Yeah, that bonus con, Bon Con. It is so good. The episode that we did, Drea came on, as did Winter Mitchell Rohrbaugh. I have to see her last name, her full last name. And also Danielle Radford from Tights and Fights. So we got Pop Rocket stuff in there. We got Who Shot Ya stuff in there. And we got Tights and Fights stuff in there.
It was the most fun ever. We talked about an episode, obviously, of Murder, She Wrote. If you are familiar with April Wolf, you're familiar with her obsession with the show. And yes, so for $5 a month, you get that plus 100 hours hours of additional bonus content.
Oh my God, it is amazing. Some of the other shows, we've got Reading Glasses, The Flop House, some of my favorite shit. Oh, Heat Rocks? Damn.
Heat Rocks! Morgan, shout out!
Okay, so then we've got also, let's say you can afford the $10 monthly membership. What do we get for the $10 monthly membership?
I can tell you, April, you get a exclusive enamel pin designed by Megan Lynn Crott. It is so cool, and it's Switchblade Sisters. It's got some knives on there you can represent. So you get this pin that you wear in the public, and the other Switchblade Sisters fans see you, and you join a sort of kinship. I'm sure covens will arise this way.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You also get that sweet 100 hours bonus content. And then for $20 a month, April...
Oh my God. It's
you know
beautiful.
That I love this one. There's oh my this God, super, he's super beautiful. Stunning 550 piece puzzle. And I love it so much. It's super retro looking. It's the kind of thing that once you put it all together, you can put it in a frame and put it on your wall like a super cool person.
Or just destroy it and start put it together all over again. Whatever your mind does.
Your personality is one of those ways or a whole other way. And both of those options are available to you for $20 a month. At MaximumFun.org/donate. And then if you do the $20, you also get the pin and the bonus content.
Ah, what about
$35? $35. You get a sweet, sweet glass mug with the rocket ship, the Maximum Fun rocket ship on it. It's a real classy mug that has a catchy little, it's got a slight kitschy vibe because again, it's a little retro design, but it's real sleek. It looks like it would hold some delicious beverages. Mug plus puzzle plus pin plus hours.
We like some beverages.
Oh, yeah, we do.
Okay, so it's a huge, huge bonanza of things that you can get. But, you know, that's not all that you get because what you get is our love.
Yes, these are our thank yous for you bringing in that support so you have something and can play with something or show something off. But the real thing is there's something awesome about being supported by the community and having people literally invest in what we're doing and kind of saying thank you back. So
yeah, and we will continue to keep making everything as good or hopefully better
yes.
So that you are just enjoying your life every day listening to Maximum Fun.
I will say on a personal level that when people are donating, it's not just going to, you know, cog in the machine. I get some money from Maximum Fun. I'm not like, you know, rich enough to sadly buy everyone I know a Maserati. Believe it or not, that's not the kind of money that's coming in from podcasting. But it's something that tells me that my sharing matters to people and that my voice or my opinions and what I'm taking, you know, how I'm taking things on means something. So it means a lot to me that people care enough that I get something back from it as well.
Well, and I have to say that it's kind of, I don't want to say it's a thankless thing to do all the research that I do for this show, but it is very lonely. I'm sitting in my room. My husband's always in a different room, and I'm always watching movies, and I'm always doing deep, deep research on things because I want to make sure I'm a teacher's pet, and I always want to get the gold star doing the best that I can. So I'm working very, very hard on this. And I have to say that sometimes it gets a little bit lonely. And then when you get in the studio and you record, it's amazing because you get to hear all these, you know, women talk about this amazing stuff. But then during Max Fun Drive, I get to see that people are really supporting us. And I'm like, oh, this is why I'm doing the show.
This is why April Wolf is finding the amazing connections between a documentary political filmmaker and the film Matilda. It pays off.
It pays off. So where can they go? They can go to
MaximumFun.org/donate.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by the Soska Sisters from Canada, and we're talking about Dead Ringers. Okay, so something that happened, you know, Cronenberg, when this movie came out, was so afraid that people who loved The Fly... we're going to be like, this isn't The fucking Fly. because it's not. And yet it still has, you know, what we were talking about, that Cronenberg imprint on it. There is still the same kind of feeling to it, the same kind of existentialism to it. But it was just invisible effects over very overtly kind of wet special effects. And so he was very worried about that. He had been offered the roles of director for Beverly Hills Cop and Flashdance after The Fly and turned those down. Thank God.
Could you imagine?
I need a Beverly Hills Cop by David Cronenberg.
Yeah, he said those movies would be fun to watch, but they wouldn't be fun to make. I couldn't get very excited about them. It's one thing to spend an hour and a half watching a movie, and it's another to spend a year and a half of your life making it. For me, a project has to have a lot of intensity, a lot of obsessive something to get involved in it. I'm not really a project director that way, and I wouldn't be able to do a good job at it. So that's what I thought very interesting. Was
it
like,
sounds so like him, because that happened again. True Detective offered him a season to direct, and he was like, nah. Masters of Horror asked him to do an episode, and he's like, nah.
Nah, I don't really call myself a Master of Horror. I mean, he's always just been too cool.
Again, he's very precise in what he wants to do. So when you see a movie that's so strange, like Dead Ringers, and you say, this is what this man was obsessed with and was driven to do and needed to do for at least two and a half years of his life, you know, it's just says so much about the man.
So much so. And he said, I remember talking to him, and he said all of his movies take around 10 years to get made. And I'm like, wow. Because I'd think as soon as... Yeah. But then again, like where he's been making movies for over 40 years, and today we're still talking about his concepts because he was so ahead of the curve. Like 40 years from now, he'll still be ahead of the curve.
Yeah. Yeah. He's also, I mean, it's one of those things where in Canada he does, as a Canadian citizen, he still has these very deep roots to Canada. And at that time, you know, he had made 11 films and never shot a movie outside of Canada. And he was, and so this film, Dead Ringers, was able to get film financing last minute through Telefilm after Dino De Laurentiis' company had pulled out. Dino De Laurentiis had done The Fly, had financed that. And like last minute, the financing had pulled out and they were just like, okay, what do we do? And so they had to go to Telefilm in Canada, and that's the only way that they could make it. And it took another 10 months to put the financing together. So I think it's just like constant, you know, like, do we really want to do this with David? Do we really want to tell this story of, you know, two obsessive twin gynecological brothers?
You know, that's like, the curse of being a trailblazer, because if you're the first one doing it, who can you say that you're like? It's like, no, it's just me. I'm doing me again. I like to, when I have a weird movie like American Mary, I was like, it's like Clockwork Orange. And they're like, great, it's like that. And I'm like, no, it's like that in the way that nothing else was like that on the time that it came out, but it ended up being very successful. And they're like, no, we don't want to take a risk on that. I can only imagine in 1988. Yeah, it's going to be two gynecologists. It's going to be a split screen, which is a technology that almost nobody is using. And it's going to be this international actor.
But think about horror movies. I mean, almost every horror movie has, it's almost like slapstick humor when a guy has his genitalia, anything. They're like, oh, he got hit in the dick. Oh, ha, ha, ha. But a woman in that situation, you've never seen that. So when you have all of the situations that the characters are in while they're being examined by these doctors that the audience knows is crazy, it's absolutely crazy. Like, Jen and I have this joke that we want to remake it, but do a gender swap and have them be proctologists, because imagine the power exchange with two women having to do that. And
gastrointestinal surgeons, master surgeons, because there's such, every time I've pitched it, guys are like, oh, well, I couldn't do that. I'm like, that's the same reason. That's how women feel when they say gynecologist.
Yeah, and it's so effective. And also there's just such a, there's more of a taboo, I think, around that than the female anatomy, because guys are just like, it's not ever explored, as pun intended, that as that comes out.
Yeah, and female sexuality is so different from male sexuality. I mean, I look at the Mantle brothers and I'm like, I can tell what your mental illness is from the way the both of you have sex.
Yeah, and you know, I'd love to see that explored with women, because I don't know if I've ever really seen it, because it's always the cutesy twins or the bimbo sororities, which I'm sorry, film gods, I've probably played them all with Jen as background actors in Vancouver.
It's a long crawl to the top, my friend.
Yeah, well, you know, you need motivation to make Dead Hooker in a trunk.
But, you know, I think that would be so interesting because what if you saw actual, like, a sexual identity that women have and they have sexual dysfunction? And plus, I mean, think about that weird kind of power exchange about men being like, okay, she's doing this to my butt. I mean, I think it's very interesting. And plus, there's so many weird ways that you can talk about the codependence between a female relationship where it's not where you think it's like, you know, just titillating. It's actually a human relationship that's very complicated.
And that's mm-hmm. the most beautiful thing about the Mansell brothers. Like when Beverly falls and Elliot's like, get away from my brother. Don't touch him. He's my brother. Like it's there's just such a... You're ride and die bitches when yeah. you're real twins. I mean, that you can't even compare it to that level of closeness. And I think everyone has the potential to be that open with somebody. But when someone's like, my husband's like my twin, and I'm like, okay, I'm sure he is a lovely human being, but no. No, I
they
mean...
They can assimilate, Jen. Humans can have hive mind relationships like you and me.
We've had 35 years of very shared experiences. Anything separate, we've been like, well, we have done the Elliot thing. So the first and Bev thing, like, where I'm like I've gone out and I've shared what I've done without you in detail. We've even read books that way that yeah. you'll read, you know, a Stephen King novel that's 1,100 plus pages and then you'll tell me the cliff notes and then I'll try to read and I'm like, I didn't like it as much when I started to read it.
The
I liked
stand.
It when you told me. It's a lot of pages. Oh, no one God. Has time to read a Stephen King Bible that often.
But there's also weirdness in twins that I don't understand, kind of like a Dr. Mengele experiment. Like when Jennifer and I were teenagers, we were talking about dreams and we realized we have the same dreamscapes of places that don't exist that we see the exact same way. And I was like, how is that possible? And where is the reference for it? Like, I see so many things of twin mm-hmm. literature that has nothing to do with twins, where as a person who is in this very small niche group, I'm like, where's the exploration there?
When we're separate, we have shared emotions. Like yeah. if you're stressed out, when we very, you know, had to be forced to work in separate places, if something happened to Sylve, I would know. Yeah. Or if she was in duress, I would know, and vice versa.
It's that separation anxiety, and it's so interesting, like towards the end of the movie where Beth is like, so Elliot called, well, maybe when I was sleeping with, and he hadn't heard from him for a week. That is devastating to the twin relationship, especially one that's so codependent mm-hmm. like that. And a lot of, I think in that movie, because Elliot is so strong for his brother, you don't see how vulnerable he is because he needs Bev there. Bev might be a more of a passive character, but he also is somebody who controls his brother and what his brother does.
Can I change a little tack to gonna talk a little bit about this ending and the way that David Cronenberg approaches one very particular theme in many of his works, which is yeah. suicide. Yes. Because he said, quote, ending your life is an extraordinary concept. You can understand why various religions totally condemn it. Not all of them. Some do quite the opposite, as we see every day. But when people do it, it emphasizes that it is available to anyone at any time. And so much of life is self-preservation, not just human mm-hmm. life, but animal life, the absolute opposite of suicide. You might say that it's only truly available to human beings because you have to have the self-consciousness that only humans have before suicide could even be considered. In recent years, it has become very politicized, of course, because people are living longer and therefore suffering more from strange or mm-hmm. obscure diseases, often very painful, exotically painful, to the point where no drugs can help. He said, I'm probably past that kind of particular suicide, the died way too soon kind of suicide, but it's a sort of strange hidden source of power that everybody has. And so he plays with it in terms of a potential and as a dramatist. But at the same time, I think he's also understanding that it's a kind of a dangerous thing to play with. Too much in your films. And I was wondering if you could talk about
that. Well, it's awesome that we're talking about suicide when a twin kills another twin, because it is a murder of the self. And that whole thing where mm-hmm. he calls the actress at the end and she asks who is it, and he can't even answer about it. It's almost like Elliot decided that he was holding Bev back, and so he was going to just take himself out of that equation. And the fact is, there is no Beverly without Elliot. They're one and the same. To have such a medical and look at suicide, yet he sprinkles in what religion has and is an opinion on that. It's so interesting to how well versed, and I think a lot of the time, like, him getting a negative reaction about Dead Ringers was ridiculous because he's so articulate and he's so thoughtful and he's gone through so many different thought processes on why this happens and what different reasons and what kind of impact it has. I think it's always done so thoughtfully and artistically with him.
And it's an important discussion to talk about suicide, because to be honest, we've all thought of killing ourselves at one point or another. It's not an unusual feeling. I mean, we've all felt overwhelmed. We've all thought it could be just, you know, over so quickly, 40,000 men and women every day.
Sylvia Plath dying for attention.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it is actually such a triumph that we don't all just off ourselves, because we always have an excuse. It is such a battle to keep living. The easiest thing in the world is to die.
But then at the same time, it takes a lot of strength of character. I have a friend and a very close friend of his was terminal, and he was given only a few weeks, and it wasn't something that would be extraordinarily pleasant in any way to go through. And he threw a party for all of his friends, and then he had a nurse there that would administer the euthanasia afterwards. And I thought, wow. And I remember my friend talking about that experience. I was like, what was it like? And he said, it was one of the hardest things I ever did. And he's like, but I understand why he wanted to do it, because he wanted control over his life again. And he was medically put in a situation where he lost his control, and that's the way he re-grabbed it. And I mean, Jennifer and I are Catholic. We were two of the first female altar servers in Western Canada. So I know what the church's opinion on that is. And I know like the downfall of looking at, like, it becomes so regular that people don't want it. It isn't available for them. But you have to look at even how we handle our pets. Like, once a dog or a cat gets too sick, we do the most humane thing to make sure that they're not in any pain. And if people are feeling the same way, like, I don't want to go through that excruciating experience, I don't want to lose myself, I don't want to this, then what is the power of self? At what point do we say we empower the individual to make that kind of decision? Like, should religion and politics have any say in that? I don't think so. But, you know, those are the ultimate controls we have over society.
And it's such an intimate decision.
And it is. And as dramatists, you know, I'm always thinking, so, you know, the way that Cronenberg is talking about in this, and because he does use suicide and kind of self-obliteration in so many of his movies, is that he's got things on his head. He's always thinking about this, and he's kind of just inflicting his characters with them is almost like an exorcism. Like, he's ridding these viruses by putting them on his characters. And so there's a certain kind of, I don't want to say like a catharsis he seems to be putting on, which is, if everyone has these dark thoughts and you're just kind of watching it, it's almost in some ways it exorcises some of the dark thoughts if you can see it, but you don't have to act on some of those things. And then conversely, you know, you have so many discussions about if you put suicide in films and portray it very realistically, you know, then it becomes glorification. And then you get people who want to take their own lives because they see it as, you know, like, oh, this could be my grand exit, you know. And it's a really tricky thing to
do. So much so. And now we're even talking about what happened with A Star Is Born, that you have to have warnings before there's a movie with suicide because you don't know if people are going to be triggered. A friend gave me The Rules of an Attraction the other day. I'd never watched it before. And she says, just so you know, there's going to be a suicide scene in there. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting, because I remember back before, if you watched a movie, that came off as a surprise. And now we're I guess it's more education. It's wanting to be more sensitive to that kind of need. But like, Suicide Club is one of my favorite movies by Sion Sono. And it's incredibly graphic, and it just dives into that, and it talks about how suicide is contagious. But you have to look at these movies with the kind of social issues of whether it's going to affect people.
And, you know, this movie is filled with so many social issues. It is not just a little bit of body gore, a lot of twindom. It's like, it's power dynamics. It's the exoriating religion, exoriating the medical industrial complex. It's everything. And I'm so happy that you two chose to talk about this movie today.
I'm so happy that we got to do this and talk about twins. We never get to twin it up enough.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. And again, people will be able to see the your version of Rabid coming sometime to festivals.
Yes, later this year. Soon. And then when there's the LA screening, please come out. We'd love to have you.
Yes, yes. And then also keep an eye out for that Black Widow, people.
Next issue is out March 27th.
Oh, I love it. Okay, thank you so much. And we love you. And have a great day in Canada.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to my conversation with the Soska sisters. Now, it's time for my chat with Michelle Meek, author of Independent Female Filmmakers, A Chronicle Through Interviews, Profiles, and Manifestos. She called in all the way from Berlin, so you may notice a little bit of background noise. It's not too bad, though. Enjoy. Hi, we're having a little break from format on because we have a person who has made a book on the show. She's also worked in film, too. Her name is Michelle Meek, and she has edited this book called Independent Female Filmmakers, A Chronicle Through Interviews, Profiles, and Manifestos. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
So happy that you could come and talk with us today. I would love for people to know a little bit about this book and a little bit about the work that you do. So if you could maybe give us a background of how you came to putting this together.
Sure. I have spent a long time in my career advocating for female filmmakers and, of course, being an independent filmmaker myself. And this book is really a culmination of a lot of my interests and passions over the years. It started because I helped co-found the Independent Media Publications, which resurrected the archives of the Independent Film and Video Monthly, which was a print magazine that ran from 1976 to 2006. And when the organization that was running it was going under, I came with a group of others to help make sure that those archives didn't disappear.
Yeah.
And this book is really part of that history, because all of the interviews that we did in the book are a then and now, and the original interviews were from the Independent Film and Video Monthly, and then we reconnected. So there's 15 female filmmakers featured in the book. They are all legendary female filmmakers, really legendary filmmakers, period, who really changed the genres and industry and made important work that I think that we really need to still pay attention to.
Yeah, you know, you have, one of our former guests, Martha Coolidge, in there, really wonderful. Sharon
right.
Dunier, Miranda July, Barbara Koppel, Deepa Mehta, and then I saw Lizzie Borden as well, you know, that I've definitely read through those interviews. And so these are, you know, women who changed the industry. And, you know, I'm curious, you said that you had these before and kind of later interviews that you were doing. What did you want to try to hit on when you were re-interviewing these people?
Well, I think there's something very significant about talking to someone when they're making or they've just made a project versus thinking about how someone reflects back on the work that they've made years ago or that they have, you know, their career as a whole. Mm-hmm. And I also think that, you know, in terms of thinking about how the industry had changed, how women in film had changed, having a wider view of looking back was important, because this book is really about female filmmakers, but it's about history. It's about film history and about preserving the film history that women have been a part of.
You and I interview filmmakers for the written word. I'm constantly worried that some of those interviews will just get lost to time, specifically women filmmakers. So, you know, it's one of those things that one of the reasons why we talk to specifically women identifying folks here is that, you know, a lot of times those interviews are lost. They're not highlighted, and that is a crucial part of film history that we're not thinking about. You know, of course, Alfred Hitchcock's, you know, interviews will always be found. All of these other people, these male filmmakers, their interviews will always be archived and put into books, but, you know, it's harder to come by some of the women.
I think that's true, and one of the things that I've been realizing so much from the process of doing this project is that, yes, it's absolutely vital that we fight for women to have equality in the industry and for women to be able to get their films made and funded and all of that and distributed. But it's equally important for us to make sure that we're looking back and remembering and preserving the work that women filmmakers did make. You know, the AFI has a list of 100 greatest films, and there's not one female director on the list.
Never. I mean,
an organization should be embarrassed to put out a list like that.
And they're not. It drives me insane that they're like, oh, yes, again, here's the 100 greatest films. And you're like, really? Really? This is what you've got?
And you're just scanning down the list, and you're thinking, they didn't even want to put one token woman on? Seriously? Not even one? And, you know, I just published an article in Salon, an editorial about the National National Film Registry. This is a organization that's funded by the U.S. government. The goal of it is to preserve U.S. film history. It's not about preserving the best films. It's about preserving something that's culturally accurate. And they have only 7% of female directors on their list. It's inexcusable.
I'm curious. Okay, so when you were making this book, you have, it's not just you doing the interviews of Time Now. It's other right. people that you have doing the interviews. How exactly were you matching those up? You know, who was talking to who and who was going to resurrect?
Yeah, it was an interesting process. I mean, obviously I chose two of the female filmmakers to interview myself, Jennifer Fox mm-hmm. and Martha Coolidge. And then the rest of the interviews were assigned to different writers. Since this was a book that I wanted both to be for an academic audience and for a mainstream audience, I wanted to make sure that the conversations were comprehensible to a regular reader or film fan, but mm-hmm. also went on a deeper level into the filmmaker's work, and someone who really put the time to watch all of their films and really have a conversation that was nuanced and, you know, just had really well thought out mm-hmm. their body of work. And so I found a combination of different people depending on the chapter, and they were a combination of academics, journalists, and most of them had pretty extensive experience either with the filmmaker's work or with interviewing filmmakers.
Yeah.
Or both.
Yeah. To go back to what you were saying about this being, you know, accessible for both academics and also for just lay people who are interested, it's mm-hmm. an interesting thing. You know, an entire college course could be designed around this book, essentially.
Absolutely.
You know, and is that what you're thinking? You know, like maybe this could be like the textbook for different college classes or courses?
Absolutely. I hope so. I think it could be a textbook for women in history classes or women in film classes, certainly. But I actually put together a sample syllabus on sexual violence and consent in film using just the films from this book, mm-hmm. because there's a number of films like Borden's Working Girls and Jennifer Fox's The Tale. And there's, you know, consent comes up in so many of these films. Mm-hmm. And so you could really put together a class of just on this book, absolutely. And I think that it's really, really essential that all of us put the effort into including different kinds of films into our film classes, because if we keep I've taught independent American film for a number of years,
yeah.
and the film students already know about Quentin Tarantino and Wes Anderson, etc.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So, like, why not introduce them to some other filmmakers that they actually might not know but should? That is a much more important thing for us to be doing as professors and instructors, and this book can help facilitate that, I hope. And, you know, it helps so that if you're not an expert on this filmmaker's work, it gives you a chance to start experiencing it.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I think in my first film classes, I remember, you know, my undergrad, I don't remember being taught any women at all. No female filmmakers
yeah.
at all in the entire semester.
It's a real problem. It's a real problem.
One of the things I thought that was really interesting, too, I mean, you're talking about sexual content, consent culture, the Annie Sprinkle mm-hmm. interviews. This is, you know, it's a really, really fascinating couple of interviews that you guys have there. Can you explain who Annie Sprinkle is to people
right.
who you might
so, not know? Annie Sprinkle is, I think she was the first PhD who had worked in porn, and she focused a lot on performance art. So she would give people a speculum and let them see her cervix at like a art, you know, or play with her breasts and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so she is an unusual one to include, but she also made films, and they're obviously extremely unconventional. And in many ways, the types of filmmakers that I put together in this book, you know, they don't necessarily all at first glance seem like they fit together.
Yeah.
But it was also important for me to think about how do we include the female filmmakers that haven't that might not fit in a collection, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And in fact, with Erica Beckman, it was the same thing, because when I was trying to cut the size of the book down, because I had a constraint of how long it could be, I was planning on cutting that chapter, and the writer of the chapter said, you know, she's the filmmaker that's always cut because mm-hmm. the type of work that she's made, and you know, think about that. And it really made me pause. So I, you know, and because I've done so much work on sexuality, Annie Sprinkle was interesting to me mm-hmm. as someone who was very unconventionally playing with sex and gender, and just, you know, treating it in a way that we're just not used to seeing it be
yeah.
treated.
And I guarantee you there is no other filmmaking book that will have interviews with Annie Sprinkle. Guarantee it.
Right.
So it's like right. the place that you can find it, you know? It's like, this is where weirdos live, and it's great.
Right, right, exactly. I think the other thing that might be worth noting is that I did a TEDx talk in October 2018, and the topic is about consent and how moments go by in films and television without us realizing it, mm-hmm. but they're actually teaching us about consent. So what I'm really articulating is that every story about sex is also a story about sexual consent, and whether we realize it or not, we are teaching ourselves and our children those messages without necessarily talking about it. Mm-hmm. And we need to start having those conversations, because we can say no means no and yes means yes as long as we want. But if we're not really showing that, and we're often not, then we need to explain that what the discrepancies are here.
Yeah. I mean, you definitely get into that in something like Martha Coolidge's work, for sure.
Right.
Not a pretty picture is something that I talk about to anyone who will listen, and most people who aren't listening.
I'm amazed that you've seen the film.
It's has been making some rounds and playing in theaters in New York. But there's, you know, she actually put it
online. That's great.
She made it available
online.
Yes,
I know. So. I know she did, which I thought was fantastic.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it also made it so that I was able to go back and see it. I think that, you know, that film was so groundbreaking in so many ways, because she was depicting rape in a documentary fiction mm-hmm. hybrid fashion. And the fact that they were talking about creating rape scenes, and what does that do, and how does that feel to the actors, and there's so much in that film to talk about. And right, that's another film that could be on that syllabus: sexual consent, violence in film. Of course,
yeah, they're all out there. Thank mm-hmm. you so much for talking with me today about your book. And again, the title is "Independent Female Filmmakers: A Chronicle Through Interviews, Profiles, and Manifestos" by Michelle Meek, or edited by Michelle Meek. And Michelle, where can people buy this?
So it's available on Amazon.com, and the publisher Routledge also is selling copies directly from there too. So
okay.
Either one.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. Anansi Girl says, I love the show. Y'all teach me rad insider stuff, not only about the genre movies I love, but the super talented professional ladies you feature who are struggling with their own industry and creative obstacles. A really smart framework for featuring diverse creators. Love the conversations. Would love to see more gender diverse folks on the show as well. I'm non-binary. I can definitely guarantee you that's something that we're working on, Anansi Girl, so stay tuned. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. You can support this show during Max Fun Drive by becoming a monthly member at MaximumFun.org/donate. Again, that's MaximumFun.org/donate. Please check out our Facebook group too. That's Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Please support him. Our senior producer is Laura Switcher. Please support her. This is a production of MaximumFun.org. Please support us.
I've often thought there should be beauty contests for the insides of bodies. You know, best spleen.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.